The future is in peril. What we need now is a shining hope. Bringing the nation back. One voter at a time. This is Aaron McCready.
Welcome to AM and the PM. My name is Aaron McCready, and it's great to have you on board with us today. We have got a fantastic show for you today, and my first guest coming up in just a minute is Cecil Murphy. You, I'm sure, know him. He has written 90 Minutes in Heaven, and then also he has a book that we're going to talk about just a little bit later on, When a Man You Love Was Abused, A Woman's Guide to Helping Him Overcome Childhood Sexual Molestation. But then also in the second half hour, we're going to talk about presidential politics, as this is a political show. But as I came across this book from Cecil Murphy, I thought it was so important that we get some of the messages that he has out there and make people realize, you know, the epidemic that is going on and has been going on with sexual molestation, not only with the females or young children, young girls, but also, you know, many people don't realize that happens to boys and men as well. But we are going to talk about that, and then, like I said, later on in the second half hour of the show, after our news break, we will get back into the presidential politics. But my guest today, like I said, Cecil Murphy, he's a New York Times best-selling author and also international speaker, and he's written or co-written more than 100 books, including the runaway bestseller 90 Minutes in Heaven and Gifted Hands, The Ben Carson Story. His books, of course, have sold millions of copies and been translated into more than 40 different languages. He's also, before he went full-time as a writer and speaker, he served as pastor of Riverdale Presbyterian Church in Metro Atlanta, and also, for those of you who know, Metro Atlanta is where this show is being broadcast out of also, and he was a volunteer hospital chaplain for 10 years. Cecil Murphy, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you, Aaron, for having me as your guest.
Well, I do appreciate you coming on board. One question that I had, you know, you have written so many books. What inspires you to write these books? And really, what motivates you and drives you?
Well, first, why I wrote this book is I'm a survivor of childhood sexual abuse, and I never told anybody, and I lived in what we would call denial. It was a form of amnesia. I didn't remember it until about 20 years ago, and the memory started coming back to me. And I realized that there are a lot of other men out there who are living with the kind of pain that I was living with. And so major reason I wrote this book was to open the door and to say to people, hey, abuse is taking place all the time. The things like Jerry Sandusky situation or the Archdiocese of Milwaukee are just two examples. It's happening everywhere, as you said.
Right. And, you know, it doesn't only happen to females, but, you know, as in your case, it happens to males also. But, you know, you mentioned that you really didn't remember it until 20 years ago. What happened, you know, going all those years that you blocked it out or had amnesia about it, what happened to all of a sudden that you had these thoughts and started to remember these items?
Well, you know, we all deal with our painful ways. Pain in many, many ways. Some face them. My brother, I had two younger brothers, and I'm quite sure they were sexually abused as well, and they became alcoholics and both died of the disease. With me, it was just pushing away, not remembering it. Occasionally, some strange kind of thoughts would come to me, but nobody ever talked to me about, never thought of myself as a survivor, and I'm a runner. And one day I was running, and just out of nowhere, seemingly, the memory started coming back, and I hadn't cried since I was like 11 years old. And so I just burst into tears. I'm talking about convulsive crying, and that was the beginning.
Got you. Also, you know, did you have any symptoms or signs, you know, up to this point of what had happened previously?
Well, I looking back, of course I did, but I wasn't aware. For instance, I'm married and had a wonderful wife, and there were two or three times when one time she was quite ill, not even expected to live, and she did live. But I was standing there next to her in the emergency room. I was standing next to her gurney, and I'll tell you, Aaron, I numbed out, which is typical of survivors, which I didn't know. But I just numbed out. I could absolutely feel nothing. Mm-hmm. And that was the pattern that I went through. And when something became overwhelming, I just went numb or forgot, you know, that's part of the denial process. Right. It was only after I began to get in touch with my childhood molestation that I was able to start feeling my emotions.
Right. What did now, you said you felt numb and, you know, really had no emotions. Was this up, you know, until you started realizing what happened? Was this just normal to you, or did you realize that maybe, you know, not being able to feel, you know, emotions like other people maybe can?
I never realized there was anything abnormal about it. I guess what I thought, Aaron, was that something was wrong with me. And by the way, that's also part of what most of us survivors go through. We most of us feel different, strange, even if we don't know the reason. I always felt like I wasn't quite normal. I wasn't quite like other people, and in many ways I wasn't. But no, I didn't feel that. Not, you know, just, I didn't have the sense that something that was different from other people in that one sense, but that I was just different in every area of my life. I was like I was not as good as other people.
Mm-hmm. Right. What can women do? And you talk about this in the book. What can women do to really help their spouse when you know they realize that they've been abused, or if their husband comes forward and talks to them? Because, you know, it's got to be a very difficult thing for the man, because to me it seems like that pride would almost keep them from wanting to say anything.
That's very true. It's not just pride. That's certainly a big factor, but it's also trust. I mean, Aaron, let me just tell you that most of us who were sexually molested were not molested by strangers in the park or somebody walking down the road and abducting us. These were usually done by people we trusted, somebody in the schools, in the church, scouts, a neighbor, a friend. My case was first a female relative and then an elderly man who rented a room from us and lived with us. Those were my two abusers. And, you know, those are people I should have been able to trust.
Right. When this is going on, or when the men are talking to their wives about this, what can the wives do to encourage their husbands to talk more about it?
Yeah, you asked that question earlier. Forgive me for not answering it. I can give it to you in one word: listen. And I mean really listen. By listening, I'm talking about active listening. Look them in the eyes. Don't let their words shock you, and certainly don't try to fix them or heal them or give them advice. See, we never had anybody who really listened to us before. We never had anybody we really trusted who didn't take advantage of us, or at least that's how we felt. So a wife has got to prove something to us. It shouldn't have to be that way, but we know we're damaged, and mm-hmm. we just don't know how to trust. So I was married for a number of years before I honestly knew that my wife loved me unconditionally. I always felt I had to be good or do something to make people like me.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's a trust factor.
Right. Did she suspect anything that might have happened? Maybe that you didn't realize how you were acting, but until you realized what had happened. But did she suspect anything?
No, my wife came from a very sheltered background, and I don't think it even occurred to her. But once I brought it out, and started talking about it, here's what she said to me. She said, you know, I don't understand this, but I love you, and I'm with you, and I want to be with you through this whole journey. And really, you know, that's all I needed. I just needed her to be with me as I started to reclaim my life.
Right. What did she solely help you through this, or did you get, you know, counseling in any way, or was it just relying on her?
I did not go into any kind of a therapeutic situation. You know, you can laugh at this, but I and part of this perhaps was denial, but I always said, I will never, how can I trust somebody I have to pay money to? So is my wife, but I also had a best friend. My best friend is named David, and we'd been really good friends for probably 5 or 6 years before that. And I opened up to David, and he was just, he's like my wife. He was there. He understood. He accepted everything I said. And those two people were what took me through. They listened. They cared. They let me cry because I hadn't cried since I was 11. And I suddenly, I couldn't stop crying, it seemed. And you know what, Aaron, they let me cry. They just let me feel my own emotions. And it was so liberating for me.
Right. Well, I would say, you know, all those years of not crying since 11, and you just needed to be able to get that out, get it off your chest.
That's right. And, you know, it just, all those years, you see, I know I felt things, but I wasn't aware of what I felt. For instance, there were times when I would be angry, and I didn't even know I was angry. I remember one time we were sitting in church, and there were a couple of girls behind us making quite a bit of racket. And I turned around, and my version is I said to them very quietly and softly, please don't keep making a noise, and you're distracting us. My wife said to me after the church service, you are so mean to those girls. And I said, what do you mean? She said, you are just mean and rude and loud. And, you know, I doubt her, but I couldn't understand it because I didn't know I was rude or loud or angry because, see, I couldn't feel my own emotions.
Right. What, you know, it seems like to me people that who are abused in that way, and well, just abused in general, really, you know, they have extremely tough lives and tough times in society going forward. But, you know, to you, you're a successful author. You've been in many endeavors. You know, in addition to, you know, you blacking it out, having the amnesia about it, why didn't it happen to you? Why didn't you just totally shut down and become, you know, like so many people?
I don't know. Maybe it's the grace of God. But let me tell you, the one factor I'm aware of in my life is because I felt worthless. And I never felt my parents loved me. I never did. And so the driving force in my life, I wasn't aware of it, but the driving force in my life was just to make my parents feel I was worthwhile. I kept doing everything to get my dad's approval, especially my dad's approval. And, you know, if I do something outstanding, he would say, yeah, it's okay. I mean, that was the best I ever got from him. I just wanted him to love me and accept me and approve of me. And Aaron, that brings me to something else. You know, my saying is,
sure,
people talk about protecting their children all the time. And here's the best thing that people can do to protect their children.
Mm-hmm.
And that is love them. Now, parents may love their children, but unless those children feel loved, unless they know that those parents truly love them, they are susceptible. I think we were created to be loved and to feel loved. And if we don't get it from our parents or the people important to us, we'll be susceptible to perpetrators around us.
Right. You know, you mentioned, you know, parents and feeling loved, and it comes to my mind that, you know, so often a spouse is doing the abuse, but then, you know, the husband or wife knows that that is going on, but they really don't protect the child. Why is that in so many cases, do you think?
Maybe they don't know how. They feel inadequate. They just don't know what to do about it. See, I think we're just finally opening up. You know, you said at the beginning of your program that we always assumed that sexual abuse was a a female issue, and we're now beginning to realize that statistically it's 1 in 3 girls, and the general statistic is 1 in 6 boys, but we're now beginning to think it's probably about the same for boys, about 1 in 3. And if we don't receive the love, affection, tenderness from the significant people in our lives, we will get it somewhere else. We will unconsciously allow someone to abuse us.
Right, and you know, you bring up a good point, because so many times when people talk to either, you know, sexual predators or just abusive people in general, they go back to the, you know, they were abused as a child and they were neglected as a child, and so it really does affect generation after generation.
Yeah, and you know, I don't want to say that everybody who was abused became an abuser. I certainly didn't, but certainly everyone who is a perpetrator or an abuser, well, I won't say certainly, but statistically, something like 95% of molesters were molested themselves. They just, what they're doing is they're duplicating a pattern that was in their own lives. They're just doing what they knew that was done to them.
Right. What is it going to take for America to wake up to this problem, this epidemic again that's going on? Because, you know, we could pass all the laws that we want to, but, you know, that's not going to change what goes on behind closed doors and in the home.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, you're right. I think the more these truths come out, and I really believe it's true about people like Jerry Sandusky you know, the Catholic priests, and there have been some scout leaders and some prominent ministers who've been involved in sexual abuses. When those come out, the more those that come out, the more it we'll be able to do something. This morning, I did an hour-long interview, Skype video interview with a counseling group in Seattle, Washington, and they told me that the reason they asked me to come is because they're getting more and more men now coming into their offices and saying, we need help. And they don't come in to say, we've been abused, but they come in and say, you know, we just need help. Things aren't going well in our lives. And after a while, they kind of settle down. They trust their therapist. And then they finally admit that they were sexually abused. So it's beginning to happen. And, Aaron, you're helping.
Well,
this program is one of the ways that we get the word out there, isn't it?
Well, you know, that's true, and I appreciate you saying that. But, you know, anything that, you know, anyone can do to bring light to this, to make other people realize it. Like you said, the news media, they're, you know, in my opinion, you know, when they're going over the Jerry Sandusky story, the Catholic Church, and, you know, they're trying to create this sensationalism news, you know, I think a byproduct of that is just the awareness and making men feel like that, hey, you know, I'm not the only one. You know, there's other people out there, and making them feel comfortable to come forward.
Yeah, and, you know, I think one of the things we have to remember with men is we live in such a homophobic culture,
mm-hmm.
that we're so afraid that if we acknowledge that we were sexually molested, people will think we're gay when we're not, we think there's obviously something wrong with me because boys don't get abused, or if I was really a real male, I would have fought my way. You know, all those kinds of crazy reasonings. And we were children. We were 5, 6, 7 years old. You know, we're trying to look back and put on ourselves a burden that we have no right to carry.
Right. And, you know, I think, too, a lot of society is to blame for the images that they put on men compared to women, because you think when there's allegations and accusations of abuse that happen in school, when it's a male teacher, you know, abusing a female student, then that carries a lot more weight and a lot more grief and shame, and people just can't believe that happened, than when a female teacher abuses a male student. It
right.
Seems like to me, you know, it's almost like, you know, the society, and this is the best way I can think to say it, is, you know, almost for that male student, oh, wow, you know, that male student is sleeping with the female teacher. But, you know, that's the exact opposite. That female teacher is abusing that young child.
That's right. And I've heard people say, he should be so lucky. You know, lucky? This is a child. This is a child who doesn't have enough maturity to realize he's being taken advantage of.
Right. And I heard an interview that you said somewhere, and you referred over to Tyler Perry when he said to Oprah that he felt that his body betrayed him when this was happening. Can you explain, you know, when you had the interview, what you meant by that?
Oh, sure. Look, the body is made this way. If you start stimulating parts of my body, for a male, we're talking the penis. If you start stimulating that, I'm going to react. It's a natural phenomenon. That's the way we're created. And that's what I mean by our body betraying us. And see, we don't understand that. It's like, oh, I responded, so something must be wrong with me. I must have wanted it. Or we make all kinds of excuses. And it's simply the fact that something was done to us, and we didn't know how this worked.
Right. And, you know, that's got to create a lot more guilt, because in your mind and your soul's saying no and telling you don't want it, but your body to them is saying something entirely different.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, when we're children, we can't make that. We can't reason that way. We're not mature enough. And so then, when we look at it again as adults, then we blame ourselves for not taking action. Hey, we were defenseless little kids.
Right.
And we need, I'm sorry, I'm just going to say, and we need to be compassionate toward those children.
Right. I think the exact wrong thing you can do to someone if a child does come forward, whether it's a boy, a girl, man, woman, is brush them off and say that they're crazy or they don't know what they're talking about. That just shuts them down even more.
Oh, and you know, I tell you so many stories of boys who've tried to, we call it break this conspiracy of silence. I right here in Atlanta, I remember this fellow in red said he got so tired of it, he told his family at dinner time, and his mother just ignored him and told him to pass the peas or something like that, and they never talked to him about it. And he said, I grew up feeling that something was wrong with me, and it was my dad that was doing it.
Wow. What developmental problems does this cause that maybe people can pick up on, that say aunts or uncles that aren't in the household but interact with the family, and maybe, you know, the mother or father are in denial that something's happening inside the house? What can other family members pick up on to maybe help the child out?
Well, sometimes the child who's been abused doesn't know what to do, but just says, I don't want to go to Uncle John's house anymore. I don't like him. And, you know, if a parent could say, well, let's talk about it. What's going on? What, you know, why don't you want to go there and really get him to talk about it? And if the kids know that they're going to be believed, it's quite likely they will talk about it. I think the other thing is to look at the behavior of the kids. You know, kids who have a little sense of self-worth, they feel like they're useless, they're no good, that's not normal.
Right.
And something has happened to them that makes them feel that way. And one of the things we can learn to do is to be sensitive to those needs.
Right. You know, and if you're just joining us, we are talking with New York Times bestselling author Cecil Murphy on his book, When a Man You Love Was Abused, A Woman's Guide to Help Him Overcome Childhood Sexual Molestation. One thing, too, you know, and I was able to receive the book and haven't read the entire book yet, but I'm working on it. But one thing that I started thinking, yeah, I am. And
thank you.
One thing that, you know, I was thinking as I read it was that, you know, this is a good book for women to better understand men, even if their spouse, their husband, isn't abused. It helps them better understand men and men's thinking processes.
Yeah, also, and let me just tell you something, Aaron. The reason this book says for women, and I did try to help women with it, but it took me 2 years to sell this book, and I sell almost everything I've written. I have now written and published to date 127 books, which is kind of insane, but I have. But I could not get a publisher interested in this because they don't believe men can men buy books. Statistically, men only buy, only about 14% of men buy books, but that's in bookstores. But a lot of men go online, and that's where this book sells the most. But so they felt no man would buy the book. So they said, aim it at women, and maybe we can sell a few copies. They printed only 3,000 copies, and we sold it all the first 2.5 months. So so they finally realized there really is a market. In fact, Aaron, I have a follow-up book coming out in the spring. It'll be called Not Quite Healed.
Oh, wow. And you said that's coming out in the spring?
It's coming out in the spring.
What exactly do you discuss in that book? I know it's a follow-up book to this one, but without revealing too much.
I don't mind. When I wrote the first book, I thought I'd written everything I knew about male sexual abuse. I'm serious. I'd written so much about it. I thought I'd written everything. And the publisher even then said to me, what are you going to do for a follow-up? And I said, there is no follow-up. But I'm now speaking to groups. For instance, I was in El Paso in February and spoke to about 90 adults. And the night before, I spoke to 100 teenagers, of which 40 were boys. And I had them in a separate group and talked to them about sexual abuse. So I'm talking more and more with people about sexual abuse and getting more and more response. And so as I get response, I'm learning. Let me give an example of one of the things I'm talking about. You know what cutting is? Girls used to do, a lot of girls who are sexually abused cut themselves.
Right, right.
Well, now I'm seeing it with boys. I never, ever believed or knew that boys cut themselves. And I don't think they used to. I think it's something fairly new.
Mm-hmm.
And boys are doing a lot of things that the girls did before in their pain. I'm just seeing so much of this going on, and kids don't know where they could go to talk.
Right. I saw a study somewhere, and I cannot recall where it was to save my life. But you said cutting is coming about, on boys, but also anorexia for
yes.
boys is also.
You're absolutely right. Another one is the pulling of the hair.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen that as much, but anorexia, yes. See, think of it this way, particularly with cutting. That's one that helps people can understand. When we've been abused, we're in pain. Cutting is painful. And it's a kind of unconscious way to control the pain. It's a form of self-medicating. When my two brothers I mentioned earlier died of alcoholism, and one of them I said to him one time something about his drinking, and he looked me right in the eye and he said, "You don't understand. When I drink is the only time I'm not in pain."
Oh, wow.
I felt so awful because I was beginning to deal with my own abuse, and I tried to talk to him about abuse, and he just said, "Just leave me alone. I found a way to take care of my pain."
Wow. What can people do to, we were talking about what people can do to help people that come forward and speak, but if you really do suspect that, but someone just will not, admit it or own up to it or confront that, what can you do to help that person?
Well, first, who are we to say that we have to confront them or they have to acknowledge it? I think sometimes we live in this culture which feels like we got to get it all out there, and it just doesn't work that way. What if you suspect, I think there are ways of saying to a man, I don't know what goes on you. I just feel there's a lot of pain in there. I want you to know that I'm here for you. And don't just say those words. You need to be there for the person. See, we were taken advantage of. It's hard for many of us to trust. So just to say I'm here for you is nothing. But when you show me that you're there and that you care, or if I tell you a little bit about myself and you accept me, it will then encourage me to talk even more.
Right. Well, I really do appreciate you coming on the show, and I hope to some of our listeners out there that, if they have been abused, whether it's a man or woman, boy or girl, that they know that they're not alone, that this happens to many, 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 million, millions of people in this country. and that they're not alone, that they can come forward and find a safe place and have a safe place where they can talk and get help.
Aaron, may I also mention, I have a blog called menshatteringtosilence.blogspot.com. menshatteringtosilence.blogspot.com. Or you can just Google my name, Cecil Murphy, and it'll tell you how to get there. But I do this twice a week, and it's very open forum. They can post with their name. They can do it anonymously. They can do it any way they want. And a lot of men now are really opening up online. I've had two former perpetrators actually blog. So we're getting the word out there slowly, but we're getting it out there.
Well, good. And if they're looking for your book, where can they find that?
Oh, good question, Aaron. Thank you. Any bookstore ought to have it, or go to Amazon and get it all, order it online.
Well, sounds great, and I hope our listeners do that. Mr. Cecil Murphy, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Aaron, thank you so much for having me as your guest.
Thank you.
Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Cecil Murphy, the New York Times best-selling author, and we were discussing his book, When a Man You Love Was Abused, A Woman's Guide to Helping Him Overcome Childhood Sexual Molestation. Hopefully, you got something from that. I certainly did, and, you know, if you have been abused out there, I hope that you do come forward and get help. This does seem like it's an epidemic, and the reason that I brought him on the show was to discuss that, because so many times in the news we hear about the Catholic Church and the Catholic priest, but you know it doesn't only happen in the Catholic Church; it happens in millions of homes all throughout the country, and you know, teachers see this every day, you know, the destruction that it causes, but. You know, we are a political show, and we just took a little bit of time to talk about that because, to bring him on board to discuss, you know, these issues, and maybe it will help someone out there. But we're going to take a break here in just a minute. We're going to get back into the political side of things. We're going to talk about our fabulous leader once again, Barack Obama, and his little trip over to Afghanistan. That was very, very timely. As you know, we are on the one-year anniversary of the death, thank goodness, of Osama bin Laden. We're going to talk a little bit about that. And then also, what exactly is Mitt Romney going to have to do to win election? It is very difficult, no matter what the popularity of the incumbent president, the sitting president, to defeat them, because they do have vast resources, vast amounts of cash. And, you know, don't forget, you know, as you paid your taxes, you know, there is a box on there. Would you like to donate a dollar to the presidential campaign? I never, ever check that. And why do I never check that? Because you never know when the president is going to disappoint you, and you may not want that president in office, but yet you've already sent money to that president. Anyways, after we take news break right now, we're going to get more into that. Stick with us. The calling number is 646-200-3400. Again, that's 646-200-3400. And you can also go online to blogtalkradio.com/AaronMcCready and join our online chat. We'll be right back after this.
Fox News Radio. I'm Chris Foster. At a congressional hearing on the handling of a blind Chinese activist case, Chen Guangsheng calls in personally to ask for help, here through a translator.
The thing I'm most concerned right now is the safety also of my mother, my brothers, and I really want to know what's going on with them.
He's asking to meet with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and to be taken with his family to the United States. Chen escaped from house arrest and was put up at the U.S. Embassy until the White House says he asked to leave. Tabloid testimony at the John Edwards campaign finance trial.
The National Enquirer considered not running its now famous story about former presidential candidate John Edwards' affair with Riel Hunter and the love child that resulted. But the candidate could not agree to the tabloid's terms, according to a former campaign aide. Mark Kornblau, a traveling press secretary during the 2008 campaign, said the Enquirer wanted Edwards to sign an affidavit swearing he was not the father and that the affair had not occurred. According to Kornblau, an affidavit was drafted, but Edwards decided not to sign it.
Fox's Jonathan Sarri at the courthouse in Greensboro, North Carolina. Facebook setting a stock price between $28 and $35 a share when it goes public in a couple of weeks. That would put the company's value at $85 billion to $95 billion.
That will make it the biggest tech IPO in history, even bigger than Google's, which IPO'd back in 2004 for a value somewhere between $20 and $25 billion, and making it one of the most lucrative and very attractive deals in the market so far this year.
Fox Business Network, Shivani Joshi. Russia's defense minister warns of preemptive strikes on NATO missile defense sites if talks on them don't move faster. A Pentagon official tells Fox the system is not designed to threaten Russia. It's just about missile defense, but the Russian government says it would undermine its nuclear capability. You're listening to Fox News Radio. Fair and balanced.
Stay connected to Fox News Radio for your favorite talk shows, newscasts on the hour and half hour, and the podcasts that take you a step deeper inside of Fox News. Don't miss a single minute of Your World with Neil Cavuto daily by subscribing to the Daily Podcast.
I'm Neil Cavuto.
Get news and insight on Wall Street and other market activities, and get a wrap-up of the business news of the day.
Don't tell me about federal programs that stick to their budget. They don't.
It's Cavuto, when you want it, and where you want it. Subscribe now by going to foxnewsradio.com and click on the podcast button for Your World with Neil Cavuto. And check out other Fox News Radio podcasts, including John Gibson's My Word.
Hi, I'm John Gibson. You can get My Word every day for no holds barred opinion on the big stories of the day. Gibson, when and where you want, at foxnewsradio.com. Just click on the podcast button.
Calls for a boycott of Spirit Airlines growing after it's refusing a refund to a 76-year-old Vietnam vet with terminal cancer whose doctor told him not to fly.
In a telephone interview with FoxNews.com today, Spirit CEO Ben Baldanza says Meekins was refused that refund because he didn't buy the $14 travel insurance they had offered, and repaying him would be, quote, cheating other customers.
We very much feel badly for Mr. Meekins, and we greatly support the men and women who defend our country. We're not anti-vet. We're not unpatriotic, as many people have accused us of, including on the air. It's just a simple case of accountability.
Baldanza likened the situation to a homeowner with no policy calling up an insurance company after his house burns down.
Fox's Laura Ingle. So far, 8 of 13 people charged in a Florida A&M drum major's hazing death had turned themselves in by this afternoon, according to state police. Robert Champion was beaten to death on a bus after a performance. His mother, Pam, says there was a conspiracy to cover it up.
So they say that these people murdered my son on that bus, and then for them to turn around and deny, run, scatter, hide, and then to have people to come back and say, this is what you need to do to make sure you don't. That's wrong.
The school has suspended the marching band program and set up a task force to stop hazing. The first trial in a three-state stabbing spree.
A jury has been selected in the first Michigan murder trial of Elias Abulazam, accused in a series of stabbings 2 years ago. The native of Israel charged with killing Arnold Miner in 2010 in the Flint area, where he's accused in 3 murders and 6 attempted murders, although police believe he may have stabbed as many as 14 people. Abulazam, captured at an Atlanta airport, also charged with attempted murder in Ohio and suspected in similar attacks in Virginia. Lillian Wu, Fox News Radio.
And I'm Chris Foster, Fox News Radio.
A colorless landscape. The future is in peril. What we need now is a shining hope. Bringing the nation back. One photo at a time. This is Aaron McCready.
From time to time, we've been tempted to believe that society has become too complex to be managed by self-rule. That government by an elite group is superior to government for, by, and of the people. But if no one among us is capable of governing himself, then who among us has the capacity to govern someone else? We're not, as some would have us believe, doomed to an inevitable decline. It is time to check and reverse the growth of government which shows signs of having grown beyond the consent of the governed. Can we solve the problems confronting us? Well, the answer is an unequivocal and emphatic yes. And after all, why shouldn't we believe that? We are Americans.
Welcome back to the show. I'm glad you've joined us. That was the late, great Ronald Reagan talking about this country. And you know what? It almost seems like he was foreshadowing. Yes, he was talking about the time he was president in the 80s. But you know what? That definitely reflects today's thinking. Our government has grown larger than the consent of the governed, and we need to take care of that. The call-in number for the show is 646-200-3400. That's 646-200-3400. We're also being heard on blogtalkradio.com. We are heard around the world and are a feature show on Blog Talk Radio. If you want to go to our website and join our online chat, Adam there connecting our chat. And you can also comment. Welcome back. And, you know, if you didn't hear that, Adam told me that that music was a little too loud, and I can't tell. You know, I'm just a loud person, I guess, and can't hear over my own voice. But 646-200-3400 is the call-in number. Go to blogtalkradio.com/Aaron McCready. You can join our online chat. Adam's in there, and Adam is also screening the calls and running our switchboard for us. So if you want to talk to me, talk to him. He'll decide if you can talk to me. So be really nice to Adam, because he is the gatekeeper, and he can kick you off if he wants to. But, you know, as you know, and as I talked about before we went to break, Barack Obama decided to go to Afghanistan. And, you know, I'm probably going to differ a little bit than some of the other conservative hosts on talk radio, such as Sean Hannity, Rush Limbaugh. You know, I don't see a problem with Barack Obama going over and making a big deal about killing Osama bin Laden. And I'll tell you why I think that, because I think that the facts are going to come out. You know, he says that Mitt Romney would not have done that, and we've played the clip on a previous show before. But, you know, everyone knows, the American people are smart, that no president is going to decide not to kill Osama bin Laden. It's just ludicrous. So if the president wants to go and you know, be in front of all those cars and those armored cars and shout hoorah, then more power to him. I don't care. We're going to defeat Barack Obama anyhow. So, you know, let him take his time for celebrate his success. That's his only success that he's had. So we'll let him celebrate that. But also, I don't know if you realize this. This just came out this morning from the Los Angeles Times that bin Laden ordered squads to try to attack President Obama's aircraft, Air Force One. Now, I'm just going to read a little bit of this. This comes directly from the Los Angeles Times. And Osama bin Laden ordered terrorist teams in mid-2010 to blow up the planes of President Obama and General David Petraeus, then commander of NATO forces in Afghanistan, when they visited Afghanistan or Pakistan. Bin Laden argued that assassinating Obama would put a totally unprepared Vice President Joe Biden in charge of the country, which would lead the U.S. into a crisis. You know what? First of all, that just shows you what a moron he was. And I'm not talking about Obama, I'm talking about Osama bin Laden. You know, we have had, unfortunately, in our history, times that the VP became president. And, I mean, it's just ludicrous. But that just tells you the thinking of bin Laden. But, you know, thank goodness he is dead. And if Obama wants to go over there and celebrate it, more power to him. Also, as you heard in the news, also Russia threatens to strike NATO missile defense sites. Russia is not a friend of the United States. I don't care what anybody says. You know, I've had people on the show that's worked for the CIA, worked for the White House, they say that they wouldn't go that far, but I would. I would. You know, that's left over from the Soviet Union, all that old mentality. But, you know, Russia's defense minister warns that talks between Moscow and Washington on the U.S.-led NATO missile defense plan in Europe are close to a dead end. Well, you know what? Russia's not a friend. Why even bother talking to them? I mean, really. But what I want to get to now is how we are going to defeat Barack Obama. And it's going to be Mitt Romney going against Obama. And there's a few things that we really need to do and focus on. There's some areas that we have got to stick to a plan, to really stick to our message no matter what Obama throws at us. He's very good at trying to turn the argument over to something else. But there's certain areas that I believe that if Mitt Romney sticks to these, he will win the election. And first, economy and jobs, of course. We've got millions of people out there unemployed, need to support their family. Also, keeping the government in check with taxes, tax reform, and all the government spending. That has got to come to an end. Then if we also focus on defense spending, we need to up our defense spending. The best defense is a good offense. Same with the military. And then we need to focus on terrorism. We do not need another 9/11. You know, with those items, if he can stick to those, and I'm going to tell you how, and we'll focus on one at a time, then he'll win re-election. But you know what? Let's just take terrorism, for example, since we talked about the dead one, Osama bin Laden. You know, since the attacks of September 11th, there's been at least 42 terrorist plots against the United States, and those have been foiled. There's been many more that I'm sure the CIA knows about. But Osama bin Laden and his deputies have been killed. Al-Qaeda has been defeated in Iraq, flushed from Afghanistan, and hounded in Pakistan. You know, those successes are all, you know, all too often talked about Obama, and he takes all the credit for it. But what he doesn't realize, maybe he realizes it, but you know, he wants to win re-election, is those resulted from a decade of efforts to make sanctuaries unsafe. You know, cause the terrorist leaders to start to run, disintegrate the networks that they have, thwart terrorist travel and communications. You know, it's not because of Barack Obama, but how we can avoid terrorism in the future that Obama's not doing is we need to preserve the existing counterterrorism and intelligence tools. That includes the Patriot Act. Yes, I said it, the Patriot Act. You know, those items are essential to maintain the security of the United States. There is just no doubt about it. The Patriot Act has provisions to modernize intelligent and legal authorities. And they also, I don't know if you know this, but they use terrorism investigators that have the same tools that are available in criminal investigations. That way they can focus more effectively on the crime at hand. We also need to enhance domestic and international information sharing efforts. We need to have better communication between the FBI, the CIA, the State Department. That's one of the breakdowns that happened in 9/11. And then also, we need to have better communication with our allies all around the world. We need to plug gaps in stopping terrorist travel. You know, it's not airport screening. But the best way to discourage terrorist plots is to frustrate groups of individuals before they begin. Until they're rooted out, then, you know, until they're rooted out, they're going to keep coming. We need to expose them. Call into the show, 646-200-3400, 646-200-3400. That's a few ways that we can stop, you know, terrorism. There's many more, but I want to get to some of these others. We'll dive into some of these in a future show. But, for example, economy and jobs, I know there's a lot of you listening that, that are unemployed. But here's an issue that we have, and some of this you can find on the Heritage Foundation's website. But in a typical month, millions of Americans switch jobs or find work, but millions quit their jobs or let go. The net of these millions in the change in total employment is only usually a few hundred thousand jobs. But you know what? When we have 8% unemployment, it's been as high as over 10%. We need to do a better job. So Mitt Romney really needs to focus on the economy and jobs. And with his background, he can definitely, definitely do that. He is a job creator. He has created the jobs. Barack Obama, what job has he had? So I've got 8 reasons here, or recommendations, I should say, on what Romney needs to do. And call into the show if you disagree with me, 646-200-3400. But we need to end any suggestion of higher taxes. That is bogging down all of the money that the businesses have. Right now in the United States, industries, businesses, corporations have the most money they've ever had. And when you suggest that they're going to have to pay higher taxes, they need to budget for what they're going to have to pay. So they're going to hold back, hold off hiring. We need to end that suggestion. We need to cut the budget deficit. We need to advance free trade. We need to repeal laws that give rise to economically harmful regulations. And we definitely need to repeal Obamacare. And if you ever hear people talk about the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, again, that's the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Well, that's the official name for Obamacare. It's frozen businesses from hiring across America because they want to see how much it's going to cost. January 1st, your taxes on average in an average American household are going to go up $3,800. And you can thank Barack Obama for that. Your free health care, it's costing you $3,800. We need to repeal some of the unwarranted provisions in the Dodd-Frank Act. And if you don't know what the Dodd-Frank Act is, it's a financial regulation law that was enacted in 2010 under the pretense that's necessary to avoid a repeat of the 2008 financial crisis. And nobody wants to have that financial crisis again. The most problematic sections are those that create a new Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. You know what? It provides seizure of firms which grant regulators broad power to close private businesses. And we also need to repeal the job-killing Davis-Bacon Act. That requires that federal construction contractors pay the least wage rates. The act was intended to prevent the purchasing power of the federal government from driving down the construction wages during the Great Depression. You know, that's some of the economy and jobs. And I think it's really going to best suit you if on the next show, the next second half hour of the show, I really focus on one of these and really dive deep into it, because if I just touch base on all these, it's going to go over our head. You know, I think Glenn Beck does an excellent job of talking about these items in detail, and that's what I'm going to do. Not to mimic Glenn Beck or say I'm Glenn Beck, I'm not saying that, but he does a great job at teaching you these things. And I think on the next episode is actually scheduled for Tuesday, and then the one after that will be Wednesday, and we're going to have another fantastic guest. But I'm going to focus on the economy and jobs. You know, and the reason being because President Obama, he promised that the government spending would stimulate the economy. And how has it stimulated the economy? Are your friends or your family members better off than they were 4 years ago, as Ronald Reagan said? I know a lot of people that aren't. I know a lot of people that are worse off. A lot of people that are worse off. You know, It's a sad time in this country, I know. You go down the street and you see businesses closed. You see friends and family members suffering. There's more and more people dependent in America on the government. And I say this all the time on the show, and I just want to drill it into your head that if you're jobless, you do have a job. Maybe you don't get paid for it, but you do have a job. Your new job is to find a job. America's not quitters. You know, and if you need to get experience, you know, if you don't have a job, why don't you get the experience? And you're saying, Aaron, I don't have a job. Nobody will hire me. How am I going to get the experience? Go volunteer. You know, let's go volunteer. You can volunteer in almost any area in business that you want to. People love free help. And not only do the businesses get the rewards of your experience and your expertise and you developing yourself, but you, guess what? You get the experiences you can put on your resume to go find a job. That's what you need to do. And that's why we're going to focus on the economy and jobs in the next episode. You know, I want to give you a little bit of facts here. We've just got a couple minutes left. If you want to call into the show, 646-200-3400. But, you know, just facts and figures. The housing bubble of 2000s consumed huge quantities of capital. These funds no longer exist to loan to entrepreneurs. Lenders have become less tolerant and in some cases excessively so, and many businesses' investments go unfunded. We need to create an environment where people let go of this money. Corporations will let go. And then we had those yahoos again, the Wall Street occupiers back in action for May Day. Huh, what a group of losers. The Wall Street protesters. What exactly are they protesting for? They want to end capitalism. Capitalism is why we have jobs in this country, why we will have jobs in this country. Somebody call in, please, please, and let me know when the last time a poor person hired you or the last time you worked for a poor person. I guarantee you Adam will not get a call on that one because nobody can say when the last time they worked for a poor person. Poor people work for people with money so the poor people can have money. I'm going to say that one more time. Poor people work for rich people so that poor people can have money. That's how it works. We're not going to give it to you. Real quick, just breaking news. I know you heard it today, but real quick, Bachman endorsed Romney.
Today, it was Congresswoman Michelle Bachman endorsing Romney in Portsmouth, Virginia, 4 months after she suspended her own presidential bid.
I think for all of America, this is a very simple proposition this November. President Barack Obama, President Mitt Romney, you decide. Very easy.
Yes, it only took Ms. Bachman 119 days to come on board and work out her Gumby arm choreography. Of course, back then, she was going around.